You know, I feel like we're the most relevant museum in the world to people's lives, because this is the music we fall in love to, we have our hearts broken to, we walk down the aisle, we feel connected when we're lost. Like, that's rock and roll.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Lol, this is a very special episode. You have to tell everybody, where are you? You're not in Los Angeles.
No, not in Los Angeles today. I am in Cleveland, in Ohio, and I am at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And we are here today with the CEO and president of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Greg Harris.
Greg, I might as well jump straight in with, you know, Greg, you must have this thing when people are nominated for inclusion, and but you're collecting from many different areas of decades of the development of rock and roll. When did it start for you?
For the museum?
What does the hall start?
Yeah, the hall, we're now in our 27th year of being open as a museum. And by the way, 13 million people from around the world have come to this place to connect with all these great artifacts and stories. But really the concept is about almost 40 years old. And it started by a number of music industry folks in New York. The founder of Atlantic Records, Ahmet Erdogan, who put out all that great New Orleans stuff, and the founder of Rolling Stone magazine, Jan Winter, and a bunch of others. And they realized they wanted to do a special evening to honor music's own. And so they started doing an event in New York at the Waldorf in the ballroom, and they started inducting artists into this concept of a Hall of Fame. And it caught a little bit of momentum. And eventually, after a few years, they decided they wanted to build a museum. And they thought about building it in New York. They thought about other cities in a lot of places, sort of got into the mix. And Cleveland jumped in and said, we want it here. We have a great legacy of rock and roll with, you know, a lot of touring bands came through. Bowie's first U.S. gigs were here. Hendrix, when he came back, was here. And then a great sort of concert business and fans here. And then they had the Alan Freed story, of the man who in the early 50s took, you know, rock and roll was a term used on records for years, but he really popularized the phrase, and he started playing rhythm and blues music and jump music and other stuff for a mixed audience of black and white young people, and it just caught fire from there. So the Cleveland folks used that. They competed for it. They built this place, and in the last 27 years, 13 million people have come here to celebrate.
Was it just New York and Cleveland?
Yeah. Well, it was so New York, Cleveland, my hometown, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, right, which we can talk about. Yeah. New Orleans, where rightfully maybe if any place can claim the start of rock and roll. And then Chicago was interested, San Francisco was interested, but really the ones that made the strongest play were Philadelphia and Cleveland, and Cleveland won out, and here it is.
And you got the same architect who the architect who designed the pyramid outside of the Louvre in Paris.
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting. I told that, you know, our origin story in about, you know, 30 seconds, but that was probably 8 years of work. And one of the catches was when Cleveland built the museum is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation that started it said, you need to hire Ian Pei. Ah. He's the hottest architect going right now.
Oh, wow. That was the prerogative. They had to have that.
Very much so. Yeah. And then they took Pei, who was a jazz fan, by the way, and they took him and flew him around to see the Who and to see the Stones and to see a bunch of live music. And he said, you know, I get it. It's about energy. It's about energy and emotion. So he designed a very energetic building. When you look at it, it's moving in a lot of directions and has a lot of activity. And then to your point about the Louvre, what I really like to think about is that the Louvre is considered by many to be the home of of Europe's great art is the Louvre. You know, it has the Mona Lisa. It has all these other great pieces. We're the home of America's great art, rock and roll.
Wow.
Right.
Sometimes I think that's a bit of a statement, too, that when our museum was built, we were making a strong statement that rock and roll was worthy as an art form to have a significant museum.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, you know, living as I do in California, that I see a lot of geary stuff everywhere, you know, like we have the Walt Disney Hall and stuff. And they're beautiful, but I think this is probably more appropriate, you know, feels like it.
Yeah, and at the time, it was... Our history was presented very much in a classic museum presentation with artifacts and exhibits and in other sort of classic ways to, again, almost legitimize rock and roll as being worthy of a museum. And since that time, we've now blown the doors off that and we've become a bit more experiential, a little bit more immersive. The music's louder. It's in our mind, we want to be, you know, I feel like we're the most relevant museum in the world to people's lives because this is the music we fall in love to. We have our hearts broken to. We walk down the aisle. We feel connected when we're lost. Like, that's rock and roll. And while other museums are terrific and I love fine art and other things, it doesn't speak to your soul the same way this music does.
Mm.
Well, I suppose the truth is this is the museum of the people. As opposed to the museum of, you know, the intellectuals and, like the hoi polloi, if you like. But, it feels like that very much so. I like that atmosphere. And, you know, and I've been here an hour, you know, so I haven't seen anything. Well, I've seen my exhibit, but I haven't seen anything much else. So.
What's your exhibit, Lol? What have you got in there?
Oh, it's just something I loaned the museum, like the outfit I wore in Let's Go to Bed video, you know, so that's in there.
In addition, Lol, we also walked through the Hall of Fame. You may want to...
Oh, yeah, that. We walked through the Hall of Fame, which was very, very emotional for me because you start off, you know, at the beginning with Chuck and all the people and wind round, and somewhere about 2019, it's me and Bob and the boys and... you have to see it. It kind of blows your mind to think about it, you know. Because only 300 and how many?
51.
351 bands in this thing, and it's here forevermore.
Yes.
Wow. You know, it's really kind of, it's a lot more affecting than I thought it would be, you know, because, you know, that's the way I think about things.
As you say, a lot of the things you've mentioned are, even though we're a long way from the roots of it, maybe, in Britain, where we both started, it's kind of magic language, isn't it? You know, everybody we admired when we were kids is probably featured there. What's the earliest exhibit? What's the oldest exhibit you have in the museum?
You know, some of the roots of rock and roll, some of the blues and gospel and country stuff is pretty remarkable to actually have, you know, a Muddy Waters red Fender guitar that, knowing that Muddy Waters is, you know, the guy that the Rolling Stones took their name from one of his songs, and they just wanted to visit, you know, Chess Records and meet Muddy Waters, and like their life was complete.
Right.
And so there's some really neat stuff in those early days, that sort of roots stuff that's remarkable. You know, there's other things throughout the years. The challenge, to be frank, is that it's, in addition to the 351 inductees, it's a big story. And to tell that story, there are so many artists that had a hand in it. And you think about even our sort of modern punk new wave area,
right,
where you have to somehow go from television and Patti Smith through everybody else.
Yeah.
And you could have an entire museum just about that.
Yeah.
Yes, you could. Well, maybe that's, you know, a new annex. You know, maybe me and Budgie start to raise some money for the new annex and we'll, you know, we can have. I always wanted a building called after me, you know, so we could do that.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. It it's interesting to me that I've seen, you know, I've traveled around America a lot, and I've been to some studios, I've been to all the other places that are supposed to be, you know, indicative of what we do. And you hit a very good point there, like, you know, like the Stones wanted to come and see Muddy Waters, right? So my brother, in the 60s, when all those guys came to England, that's what we heard. And my brother would go to all those kind of shows. So he had a love. I mean, he still, you know, he gets in his old van and plays John Lee Hooker still and stuff, you know.
Perfect.
So it informed us growing up, because I'm sure Budgie will tell you, one of the first ways we learned to play music was we would go off to Sunday lunchtime at the pubs, and there'd be a bunch of, like, you know, Peter Green wannabes playing the blues, and that's how we all learn. You know, we would sort of, they'd let us sit in, you know, like, we're 14 years old, and we're like, well, I can play a bit of a drum beat, you know, and they'd let us play. And so it really is, I think, to me, what this whole thing speaks of is that constant back and forth that's been going on for, like, you know, 50, 60 years, with, like, you know, little bit of England, a little bit of America, and then backwards and forwards, and it informs each other. And obviously there's influences from all over the world, but that's the engine right there. You know, I watched a little bit of the Beatles exhibit you have, and I was telling Greg, every English drummer, and that's me and you, right?
Me included. I know who you're going to say here.
We all owe something to Ringo. Yeah.
My brother came back for, he said, my brother came home one night and he said, I've got a drumstick for you. And it wasn't even a full drumstick. It was a tip of a drumstick, a nylon tip. And he said, I found it on the floor in the cavern. It must have been Ringo's. It could have been anybody's. But to me, it was Ringo's. Yeah, and I got that little tip of a nylon stick and I played the calf skin of an old banjo with no strings on it that was lying around the house, and that was kind of the first drum.
Yeah.
A banjo.
The tip of that became your Excalibur sword. That's so cool.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, the other interesting part of this, you've both referenced in short order, you know, your family, your brothers, and your influences and your connection.
Yeah.
And that's part of this. It's a thread that pulls you through those years, and it's a constant, and there's a magic to that, I think. There's a magic to the...
There's definitely a magic to it, because I, you know, I just saw that they've got a film by Jonathan Demme, and it has basically all the people that you know. Doesn't have us in yet, but, you know, it will. Just watching that, I had a smile on my face the whole time.
So, Greg, your roots, I'm you know, I've done a little bit of reading, and you, because vinyl and rare records are very much a thing we all still look out for when we were able to tour around pre-pandemic. I know that on tour with people I've been working with, we'd come home with big boxes full of vinyl. In Philadelphia, is this kind of the beginnings of your, if you like, meeting the recording world?
Yes, you know, I'll back up just a hair from that, then we'll get to Philadelphia. But growing up in that part of the world, we had a real treasure. And Budgie, I would have seen you there in the early 80s, but a place called City Gardens in Trenton, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
A crazy promoter that booked breaking bands and up-and-coming bands, and we would all go there. And if you had a good fake ID, you were in. And then being really interested in music, finding a bit of my tribe of the people that were at the shows and the people that were, you know, a little bit outside of the mainstream. And then I moved to Philadelphia and I worked in a bookstore that had a record department, the used department. And the other clerk and I realized the owner was making all the money and paying us $2 an hour.
Right.
So we opened up our own store. And that store is the Philadelphia Record Exchange. It was at 5th and South Street, and I'm pleased to say my original partner, I had it for a couple years and sold my half. He still has it. it's still going strong.
Wow.
And when you meet, you know, touring musicians and artists that love this, they all know the Philadelphia Record Exchange, and it's a stop where people tend to find what they're looking for. At least they find the community that welcomes them.
Yes.
It was the network. Every musician in town hung out there. But we would even get things forwarded if a band was on tour. Their distributor or their family might send something to the store.
Right.
And they'd pick it up there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought it was just a wonderful community.
Yeah.
People that worked in that world, many of them are still involved in music. And it's really pretty fun to cross paths.
You brought up a point. There's something that I remembered. One of the big stalwarts of that for me was a chap called Bill Wiseman, who it was from Dallas and run Bill's Records. He passed away, I think, last year or two. But Bill didn't leave that record store. Literally, I mean, he was at the he passed away at the counter. You know, he lived in this store. He had every record that you could ever want, and he had a warehouse full of the ones that you didn't want as well. And you know, he was there. I think I saw him there sometime in the early 80s, still there, like up until a couple of years ago, you know, and that was his whole existence, you know. And it was wonderful. I did an event for my book there. You know, I said, Bill, can I do an event at your store? And he's like, yeah, come on by. And that's the thing that's missing for me and Budgie. We talk about this. That's the thing that's missing from the internet, you know, because you can get everything on your phone straight away, but you can't get that feeling.
There is something there, and it's interesting, right? And I'm trying to fight the old our way was the better way, but there was something about hearing it being played there and talking to people and being together. Now, the balance of that is, right, you could be sitting, you know, at your kitchen table, or a 16-year-old kid could be at their table, and they could type in The Cure, and they might get led to Susie, or they might get led to the Gun Club, and then with another click, they're seeing Sun House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that's wild.
It's wild. It's also true, though, that the old way has a real good pull, because, you know, my son came and played in Cleveland the other night, and I watched the audience, you know, and that's the same thing that I saw happening with us 40 years ago. You know, people, they connect. That's their tribe. That's who they want to go and see. That's who they believe in. That's the music gets through to them very clearly that way. And it was a very amazing thing to see for me, that it's still, you know, the same thing is going on. And it's, you know, what they say, rock and roll will never die. There you go. That's it. It's right there.
I got an interesting thought just came into my head. What? Because, Greg, you worked also at the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum as well. That was your gig prior to this one, I think. How do the two worlds, do they have a similarity? Obviously, fanaticism, they have the collecting aspect of it as well.
Baseball in the U.S. is kind of a civil religion. Right? And so... What's interesting about the two places, there's a lot of commonality in that, one, we are both, you know, educational organizations that tell stories,
right,
and we're kind of held in the public trust. The people care about this stuff dearly. Mm. There's always fans that know more about artists than we do, and there's the same with baseball. You know, it cuts across generations, and it can be shared, and for The important part, I think, is that they both contain these reservoirs of memory, and you can connect and remember moments of who you're with and where you were. Baseball has a long and storied history in America. It goes back to the 1870s. And the museum there, it is a bit of a, you know, it's a pilgrimage place for people that grew up. And frequently they make that pilgrimage and they talk about their parents or their grandparents and how they listened to radio together and how they brought their children to games, and it's across generations. So that's a bit of the thread with Cooperstown, the Baseball Hall of Fame. And here you pick up on some of that. We're getting a little more generational. I doubt that our parents liked the same music we did, guys.
No.
But today it's different.
Yeah.
And the idea that there's a lot of emotion and connection tied to it. The other thing, just operationally, you know, we attract people from all over the country, all over the world, both places. We have inductees.
Right.
Curiously, they have about 350 inductees as well.
Oh, dear.
it's a very elite group.
Yeah.
And we
hope there's some Dodgers in there from 2020, because we won back then. Yeah. I know that.
And the other part, I guess, on the civil religion side that I find fascinating is people wear their team logos.
Yeah.
They wear their Cure t-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you want to be, you get the tattoos.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you want to be identified with that, and you're telling the world that this is where my loyalty lies.
Yeah.
And so when you see somebody with your same loyalty 1,000 miles from home, there's an instant bond, and you're together. So I think there's a lot of similarity, and they're both magical places that bring forth these connections in people, and it gets down to people, not just the balls or the bats or the guitars or the drums.
No, it's absolutely about people, and it's about how you approach life. You know, my son, they had a band open for them the other day in New York, and they're a young hardcore band. You know, they're all about 18 or 19, and the lead singer didn't know that Gray, you know, is my son, and they're wearing a Cure shirt. And he's like, okay, yeah, you know, hi. You know, and he sent me a film of it, you know, because it's the communication. It blows my mind. I mean, we were talking about this the other week on Curious Creatures. Me and Budge, we were talking with Will Sargent from Echo and the Bunnymen, and he was saying, isn't it weird that, you know, people like our music 40 years on? And like, and remember when you started, you know, 40 years before that was like Glenn Miller, and nobody, you know, except maybe the old folks would have liked that. But we meet kids that are 17, 18, and they still, you know, they love that kind of, they love the 80s. They love what's going on.
I have a confession, Lowell.
Yeah. You love Glenn Miller.
When I went to the pub, in the pub on the jukebox, because there was very little on the jukebox when I first went to the pub, I'd look for like things like Glenn Miller, In the Mood, because it was like class, real class music.
The King of Swing.
Yeah. And in Britain, certainly, as drummers, the drummers we grew up listening to came from the swing era. So even Bill Ward with Sabbath and Ian Paice with Deep Purple, they're swing guys. And it's really interesting, the differences, how these differences fed into different parts of the world and the development of them. But tell me, is there any crying in baseball?
There isn't supposed to be.
No, it happens, so I understand.
Wasn't that the Tom Hanks line to Madonna?
Yes, there was. There's no crying in baseball.
The two worlds met, and
you've just amazed me, Budgie. I didn't know you knew that particular fact. Wow.
It is interesting to think about that. You know, you both reference the time and distance, right?
Yeah.
So you're making records 10 years after Woodstock.
Yeah.
And only after, for us, a big reference point is the Beatles on that Ed Sullivan in the U.S. is 1964. Right. So you're only 15 years after that.
Yeah.
And if you think about today, that horizon of where we are 40-something years later, it's staggering.
It's completely staggering. Today, I found out, you know, because my phone pops up things now and again. Today is the 41st anniversary of Faith, you know, our third album. That blows my mind to think, you know, what I was doing 41 years ago, and I can kind of remember it, you know. So it's, it condenses time. Somebody said to me once as well about being on stage, and I noticed this from your film, that, you know, you get on stage and you are ageless, you know? You have no age. You know, you might be feeling, oh, I've got a bad back or something. You get out there on stage and it changes, you know? And I saw that in the film, you know, because there's like, you know, Tina Turner, who's, you know, very old now and stuff. And it's like, but no, she's not old there. She's forever young, you know? And I think that's part of the appeal to it, you know?
Yeah, Well, as fans and watching, we feel it. And it's interesting because age isn't as perceptible when you're doing it together.
True.
But to do it this far on, and for all of us to be sitting here, I think we're on the right side of the grass. So we're very fortunate.
Absolutely. And every year and every day that I'm on the right side of the grass, I'm very happy, you know, because it wasn't designed to be that way. And there's a lot, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that have not with us anymore, but me and Budgie are still here and thriving, you know?
Definitely thriving, yes. Yesterday I was doing that thing on YouTube. You know, you follow one link and you don't know what you're doing there. But I was watching the career, it was the career of Tori Amos. Tori Amos on the Letterman show. And she seemed to be on there from her breakthrough with Cornflake Girl. Right through every year almost, certainly every 2 years, until we get to 2009 or so. And it was just that, watching the change in the show and the music of the house band and what they're playing and the way they're playing it and how it's changed from funk to rock to jazz to fusion. And in the middle is this continuing thread of some artist development, Tori Amos in this case. And it's a strange thing as well, where if you're growing up in music at the same time as another artist, you almost don't see them. It's almost like a horse. I think a horse race is a bad analogy, but it's a bit like you've got your blinkers on, so you're not distracted. And so you don't really, people say, do you remember though? And I say, I actually never heard anything, maybe one single. And of course, you're on with the next album, right? You're on to the next tour. And you like ships passing in the night quite often. And I suppose where you are is a kind of brings it all into focus.
Right, right. And part of the thing that me and Budgie have found the last, this is like our second season of Curious Creatures, that we zip the thread together for all of these things and for all of these people, and we find different connections. I mean, we did one interview with Mason Silver, who's was like Thrasher's skater of the year. You know, he's like 23, I think, you know, and our connection is because he was always talked to me about music because I know his parents, and he said, well, you know, I skate to you guys. I put The Cure on and he skates to Budgie a lot. He skates to, said, because that's the music that I like. And so that's the thing. It informs everything and it's all connected. And that's what we've found more, since doing this, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know I'm supposed to be the guest, but I just want to listen to you guys.
That happens a bit. Yeah. That happens a bit. Yeah. We end up, sort of jabbering on.
Well, interesting that using that as a springboard, when you're putting together the huge shows that you have at the induction ceremonies, the last one I watched, I think, was probably with LOL. I certainly watched it a lot. The one with The Cure.
Yeah, with Roxy and The Cure.
Yeah. Oh, with Roxy Music and what's his name? LOL, you were speaking to him that night. Colin Bloodstone, is it? No?
Oh, Colin Bloodstone, yeah.
Oh, the zombies.
They were awesome.
Zombies.
Because I was right at the front watching it. Yeah, it's great.
Magical night. You know, it's a great example. When you talk with folks like you that... fans think about your bands, but your fans too. Like, this made you.
Yeah.
And that's...
Absolutely. Mm. They have a dinner the night before the induction ceremony. I was at the dinner and I was telling somebody the story that I've told you about Colin Bloodstone, how, when I was a 13-year-old boy, I heard a record that he'd made and I thought, oh my gosh, these lyrics, it proves to me you can write a song that's has some emotional heart in it, and it doesn't have to be sort of like this sort of misogynistic, rock stuff. And so when I was at the dinner, I was telling somebody this story and they said, well, he's standing right behind you over there at the bar. So I went over to him and I think I kind of surprised him a bit. I think he was a bit, he wasn't quite sure what was going to happen, because I slung my arm around him and said, Colin, I have to tell you, one of the reasons I'm here tonight is because of you. And then I told him the story, and he was like, I'm overwhelmed. I don't have any words for this. And then when they went up to get their award, I sort of snagged him on the way up, you know, and gave him a big hug. And it was, you know, that's what it's about to me. You know, you meet your influence and, you know, you go on and you do something. I mean, it's like I was telling you earlier, you know, part of the reason that we ever did anything was because, you know, we saw bands like The Clash and we thought, okay, I could do that.
Yeah.
I could do that. You know, before then, you have to remember in the 70s, it was like disco and prog rock. And a lot of time, you know, we weren't really going to do the disco stuff. And the prog rock stuff was like, hey, how am I going to do
that? Technically
perfect. Yeah. How am I going to do that? So, you know, we owe a lot to, you know, those early days with punk and stuff. Yeah, really do.
Well, and I would say that the reason you're honored here, Lowell, is because in the last 40 years, a lot of others have looked at you as a major influence, and that's the continuum. That's the beautiful part. Well,
that's making me you know, blush, and it's but it's, you know, humbling and flattering at the same time. Thank you.
All true.
What is the oldest relic that you have in the museum? What's the star of the show, or the earliest star of the show?
Yeah, the earliest star. There's some of the Roots stuff. I believe that we may have Louis Jordan's tenor saxophone.
Wow.
Which is pretty remarkable. And we have some things from Howlin' Wolf that are quite early that are really cool. And
oh, you mentioned his guitar. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so some of those things are super. Some of the things are unexpected, too. You know, we have a lyric sheet that became the start of Doc Pama's writing Save the Last Dance for Me.
Wow.
You know, little things like that that just come alive because you, as soon as you say that, you hear the song.
Right.
And it connects. Other, you know, there's even some things that as we were walking around earlier with Lowell, we stopped and looked at a Joe Strummer guitar.
Yeah, I was just thinking that brought back a lot of stuff for me. You know, it would for you too. Yeah.
Was it a dark green Telecaster?
You know what? It's a blonde one that's wood grain Telecaster with with some stickers on it that you would recognize in a second. And we did have the dark green one for a while. I believe that is back with his family.
Yeah,
that one looks like it came out of the ocean. it is like as gritty and authentic as it gets.
Yeah. I think it went into the ocean a few times. Yeah. I remember seeing that guitar tossed off stage to Johnny Green, who was at side stage catching it every night. Until the night that Johnny was on the wrong side of the stage or Joe threw it the wrong way. And it just sailed off side stage
survived.
And carried on going. And it survived. I suppose if I remember that first tour, I was with the Slits and the Clash were doing the Sort It Out tour for the Give Them Enough Rope album,
right.
I think. And I guarantee that everybody who was at all those big shows for that period in Britain will remember every aspect of that show, you know. And those are the moments, I suppose, that could all pinpoint on an article in a case with wonderful lighting, and you give it some kind of resonance, and it almost is a religious experience, you say.
Well, yeah, these things here, they are, as you say, they're like religious artifacts, much more so than, and not to, you know, denigrate it in any way at all, but I went to Memphis, I went to Sun, and you know, Sun Studios is like, you know, it's like a very horrible old studio in Las Vegas, and the guy was going, oh, you want to sing in Elvis's mic? And I'm like, yeah, it's okay, it's all right, really, you know, I don't need to do that. I just want to have been here, you know. But there are other this here gives you much more you know, it's much more perspective about what it really is and what it really means, you know. So that's really a good thing.
Context, you know, we all love things. And you're right, a well-lit guitar in the perfect space is powerful and beautiful. But that context that you just shared of that tour those moments. Right. And imagine if you see that same guitar and you hear that splash of Tommy Gunn, right? That drum roll at the beginning.
Yeah.
When you see it, you are transported so quickly with that. And you're also energized, and you remember that.
Yes.
Yeah. Full stop.
I remember it like it was just. Yeah. So,
and that's the beauty of this, because it's the items are the pieces from Making History, but the art. Is a lot. The art is the music, and the art is alive, and the art is vibrant and relevant. And you have this emotional lifetime, this reservoir connected to the art. So yeah, that's, you know, I felt it just from you doing that vocal.
He does a lot of those. He's very good at those.
It's the jukebox in the head. I'm really sorry.
Yeah. It's the emotional connection that we all like.
Greg, thanks for looking after Lol, and but thank you also for your time and just sharing a bit about what you do.
It's an honor to be on your show, and the music that both of you have made continues to inspire me and so many, you know, millions of other people. I'm honored to spend time with you guys.
Thank you, Greg. Curious questions. So this one is from Peter Ewald from Berlin, Germany.
I know that place.
You know that place?
Yeah.
You're not in there right now, are you? But that place.
I'm not in Berlin, but I do have an attraction.
You have a residence.
I have a little reason to be there, yes.
Right. So Peter's first question is, hello, Lol and Budgie. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Peter.
Question one. Your first gigs in Berlin was when it was still a walled city. Mm. Any strange encounters with stone-faced East German border guards? Fear of being gulagged or something like that?
You have to keep going a bit further to get gulagged, I think.
Yeah.
Entering the Russian steppes or the Siberian outback. We both know. Lol about that the way into the walled city of, you know, West Berlin through it only makes sense now. I'm doing the journey quite often, and I've driven the journey quite often out of Berlin. Of course, Berlin itself lies deep in the heart of the old East Germany.
Right,
almost
like a little island, wasn't it? Yeah, it was like an island
close to the Polish border. And so when you leave West Berlin, you enter old East Germany and you travel a couple of hours south and west until you reach the old East-West German border, which is kind of confusing. But that is from the East-West German border to the West Berlin checkpoint, you would have the long tunnel of access, the access tunnel by road. And we quite often on the tour bus would, as many bands did, drive down that road in the middle of the night when you were sleeping, because it's long and dull and you can't stop. So
and you can't go off of any of the ramps off of the side, because there's a little guard post and they just turn you back and you get back on the road. I mean, I was. Found it fascinating because you could see in the distance, like houses that looked still like, you know, 1945 in certain places. Like, you know, when everything had changed, it kind of stopped there. So it was fascinating to me. And I remember going on the train. Did you do the train ever?
No, never trained in. Never. I don't think we ever flew into West Berlin either. We always did the drive.
I did the train. A couple of times, and you know, they had if I remember correctly, they had, you know, the West German train to go into Berlin and the East German train coming out, or something like that. Well, they both took one you know, direction. And so the West German train was a bit like, you know, an English train or an American train, and it had a little buffet with lots of nice things to eat and
yes,
stuff. And
it was.
It was warm and comfortable. And the East German train, if I recall, was a little more Spartan.
They had the holes in the floor like the Flintstones.
It was a bit like that. It didn't have much heat going on, and there wasn't. Well, there was warm coffee and, you know, goulash or something, you know, similar, a salami sandwich, and that was kind of it. And it was actually an old West German train repainted in East German colours. So I remember, you know, we'd always try and think, well, do we want to? Can we try and get the journey where we're on the nicer train? You know, and that's not to say that, you know, it wasn't a good train, but
is that the one? It was different. Yeah, you want the one with the nice toilet paper.
Yeah, because it's a bit of a long journey. Actually, on one of those journeys, I learned how to play backgammon from Clive Timperley, who used to be in the 101ers with Mr. Strummer.
Oh yeah,
but he had gone on from that, and he was playing with the Passions with Barbara and stuff.
Barbara Grogan,
yes. So he taught me. Clive taught me on that journey how to play backgammon, and we played backgammon the whole tour. So
my goodness. Well, the reason I mentioned the toilet paper is because on the drive, of course, when you do pull over or onto the service station, you had to have money to buy toilet paper.
Oh yes.
Of course, in those days, it was Fenwick's, and you wouldn't have any Fenwick's until you'd arrived where you were going. So if you'd just come out of Holland, you had Guilders, and Guilders wouldn't buy you anything.
No. So what did you do? Did you go off in the bushes somewhere?
No, you just couldn't go. You know, just
couldn't go.
No.
It's a long journey.
You wouldn't want to go either, because obviously a lot of truck drivers had no Fenwick's either, and they didn't really care where they went.
Oh, dear me.
It was a very pleasant affair, some of it.
TMI, Mr. B.
But enough of that. Well, did we ever get stopped by? We did. Of course, you have to stop with the border guards. And what you do is you have a bunch of, as we called it, swag. Those in bands will know.
Have the swag.
The swag box, which basically is the T-shirts, the latest album, whatever else you might have that tells the border guards you're in a band, and they can probably have this stuff and take it home and give it to their children or make some money on the black market.
or you know, if they want to smooth your way through the border, which is what really we're doing it for, you know.
Like, exactly.
We would have people get on the bus, you know, the border guards in their great coats, having been standing out in the very cold, you know, East German, you know, countryside, and they get on the bus and go, passports, please. And then they'd look up and down, and they'd figure out what it was, and they'd go, T-shirts?
Yes.
CDs?
Yes.
And at that point, the tour manager, if he was worth his salt,
would otherwise,
go, here you go.
Yeah. Please, otherwise, everybody's out of their bunks, and you have to get dressed, and they march you all off to the little checkpoint office, and make you stand there in the glaring fluorescent lights.
Yeah,
and you're freezing and cold, and you're not most happy. But you can't say anything, because all you want to do is get nicely through the border and have no problems.
No problems. Yes. No
Nothing problems confiscated. All your equipment intact. All of your equipment intact. Not just the ones you plug in, but your equipment. You don't want them messing with your equipment.
No, heaven forbid.
Nope.
We had one incident that didn't really involve us. It involved our crew, where one of our crew was driving a truck through East Germany, and he was a diabetic, and unfortunately he didn't have, you know, like diabetics carry, like, you know,
insulin,
a candy bar or something, just in case their sugar level goes down. And he had a problem with his sugar level, and he ran off the road and crashed.
Ouch.
And he woke up in an East German police station, and they were first sort of kind of thinking, well, you know, maybe he's drunk or he's some kind of drug addict and that. And, you know, he had to explain, no, you know, I'm a diabetic, whatever the German word for diabetic is. And eventually he got back to Berlin safe and sound, but it was quite dangerous for a while there. I mean, all kinds of things could have happened.
It played a big role in my formative years, Berlin, and it's interesting being back there now, and being back living in Berlin. Of course, what you really notice is the build quality, the quality of the building work. you can certainly tell, the East German construction. Yes, it's a little wonky at times.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely an experience. I remember the first gig we played in Berlin was in SO36 or whatever it was called.
That's SO36, yeah. I was just reading about it, yeah.
So we played there. And, of course, we'd had this journey to actually get into this little island. And I always thought that people in Berlin at that time, there was a couple of million people in West Berlin. But they couldn't leave that easily. They could get out, and travel and stuff, but it wasn't that easy. So it was like a little island where everything had to be provided and everything had to go on. So it was quite an exciting place at that point,
But I was just reading about the girl bands that we met, got to know, Malaria. That was a band called Kleenex. They had to change their name because of the tissue paper. The ones that it wasn't the tissue that was in the toilets, in the service stations. Kleenex, the man-sized things, soft ones. They had to change their name to Lilliput.
No, I don't really see the connection there somehow. That's like...
No, it was just that, obviously, there's a band in West Berlin and they call themselves Kleenex. And Kleenex, Procter Gamble are getting worried.
Yeah.
They've got to take our name and run off with it. But they, in their little interviews at the time or write-ups that you see now, they would say how their look came from... They had to make their own clothes. They couldn't really get anything that they wanted.
Did they make them with Kleenex? Did they make them with Kleenex?
They would have probably used whatever. But I imagine they would have probably boycotted Kleenex for not letting them call the band the name they wanted to call it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But the markets they went to are still up and running. There's still these big markets, flea markets that they have on the weekends in Berlin.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.